From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 150 years ago, a girl named Alice chased a white rabbit down a rabbit hole and discovered Wonderland, a world that seemed like a dream, marvelous, upside down, sometimes terrifying. There was a real Alice behind that story, a young girl who heard the tale of Wonderland floating on the River Thames on a warm July afternoon in 1862. And a real man, Charles Dodgson, Oxford mathematician and private dreamer, pen name Lewis Carroll. This hour On Point, the story behind the story of Alice in Wonderland. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did you fall down the rabbit hole as a child? What did you find there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's just a little bit from the fifth chapter of Alice in Wonderland. Alice meets a caterpillar who helps her grow taller after she's been shrunk to the height of just 3 inches. She tries to explain to the caterpillar who she is, but after changing so much since falling down the rabbit hole, she isn't quite sure anymore. Here are Stephen Thorne and Alice, voiced by Joe Wyatt, on audiobook.
I know who I was when I got up this morning, but I think I must have been changed several times since then.
What do you mean by that? Explain yourself.
I can't explain myself, I'm afraid, sir, because I'm not myself, you see.
And indeed, she wasn't. And here from the 1951 Disney production of Alice in Wonderland, Alice, played by Catherine Beaumont, bored by her history lesson, her older sister who tells her she needs to have more sense, Alice wants to live in a more imaginative world.
If I had a world of my own, everything would be nonsense. Nothing would be what it is, because everything would be what it isn't. And contrariwise, what it is, it wouldn't be. And what it wouldn't be, it would. You see?
Disney's take on Alice in Wonderland and the Swooping Violins, of course, right there. With us now from Oxford is Robert Douglas Fairhurst, author of the new book, The Story of Alice, Lewis Carroll, and the Secret History of Wonderland. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He is professor of English literature, fellow at Magdalen College, Oxford, also author of Becoming Dickens, The Invention of a Novelist. Robert Douglas Fairhurst, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Tom.
What made Alice in Wonderland a kind of breakthrough for its time?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose it was the first time that readers were given a chance to engage with a heroine who lives in a world of fantasy or visits a world of fantasy. A little bit later, Carol remembered looking at the faces of the little girls, Alice and her sisters, on the riverbank, and he said they looked as if they were hungry for news of fairyland. And that's the news he decided to bring them, and also then the rest of the world.
I'm reading here in the Wall Street Journal, Michael Saylor at the University of California, Davis, sees this book, The Imaginings of Lewis Carroll, Charles Dodgson, as having broken down the door for Peter Pan and Sherlock Holmes and Robert Louis Stevenson and a whole age of fantasy. What do you think of that?
Absolutely, and not just those. What about Oz, again, a heroine who visits a strange world, although not in her dream that time? What about Narnia? Again, rather than going through a rabbit hole, you go through a wardrobe door into an enchanted world. What about Discworld? I think without Wonderland, we wouldn't have that extraordinary range of imaginary worlds. There's a recent book, in fact, by one of my colleagues here in Oxford, a book called Rooftoppers, where the author, Catherine Rundle, says that what do books do? That they crowbar the world open for you as a child. And that's what Alice in Wonderland did for me when I was a child. But it's what books do generally for children. And without Alice in Wonderland, I think the landscape of literature would have looked very, very different.
The Victorians, in general, I'm reading here, had been dubious about what they thought of as escapism, widely celebrated in literature and widely practiced in this century in more sense. But was there a skepticism about this whole genre? I guess it wasn't even a genre then. They wanted more practical tales that would preach to children, maybe.
Yes, that's right. You might remember in Great Expectations, there's a character called Wopsle who looks at Pip and says, naturally vicious, naturally vicious children. In other words, the children as creatures who need to be tamed, to be often beaten into the ways of civilization. But at the same time, children were thought to be like little slivers of heaven who had floated down to earth. They were angels who'd lost their wings. And that strange dichotomy in the period between seeing children as, on the one hand, inherently sinful, and on the other hand, inherently pure, that is something Carroll decided entirely to ignore. And what he does is, in the opening pages, you might remember, she picks up the bottle marked Drink Me, and she thinks about all those stories she's heard about, and these are the cautionary tales that people were reading at the time about children who are eaten by wild beasts if they do things wrong. And then she goes ahead and drinks it anyway. And it's Carroll then giving a very polite two fingers to the kind of world in which children are thought to be in need of moral instruction. And instead what he gives them is just a lot of logical but playful nonsense.
What was the reaction to Alice in Wonderland as it went from a story told on the Thames, we'll get that story from you, to something that was, I guess, first sort of privately written up for the young girl, actual girl Alice, to something published 150 years ago and out and widely read? What was the public Victorian reaction to this story?
Well, it's a very interesting story because there were two versions he was working on side by side. There was the manuscript version, which is called Alice's Adventures Underground, which he presented as an early Christmas present to the real Alice, Alice Liddell. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he was building it up and expanding it, almost doubling it in size, into the story he then publishes in 1865 as Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. So we've gone from Underground to Wonderland. Mm. And it was an almost immediate success. It sold hugely. And we know how successful it was, not just because people talked about it, but also because of an extraordinary range of spin-offs and parodies and loving imitations and rip-offs, which almost immediately flooded the market. Within a few years, Wonderland had become a really crowded place.
Introduce us to Charles Dodgson. We know him as Lewis Carroll. His pen name, it seems, this contradictory man. On the one hand, kind of an uptight, as I read you anyway, Oxford mathematician, Episcopal, I guess, deacon, but also then ready to unleash this wild imagination we see in Alice in Wonderland. Introduce us to this man.
So, yes, I mean, he's a slippery, shadowy figure, Dodgson Carroll, a reluctant celebrity. Letters that were sent to him addressed to Lewis Carroll at Christchurch were often returned with "not known" written across the envelope. And he said to one of his child friends what he really hated was being pointed out as, "That's the man who wrote Alice in Wonderland." Yeah. Why did he hate it so much? Well, because his day job was, as you said earlier, as a mathematician and a teacher of logic at Christchurch. And that, of course, is the Reverend Charles Dodgson. And yet, in some ways, he was like two strangers sharing one skin, because at the same time, he was Lewis Carroll, who is a creature he invented himself on the page out of paper and ink. And that was the storyteller. That was the man who, in his head, was the friend to children, and indeed befriended dozens or hundreds of them. And what you get in Alice in Wonderland is those two sides of his personality collaborating, because in this book, you get a world of logic and mathematical rigor slamming up against a world of play and nonsense. So that is the only place, really, where these two sides of him could cohabit on the page.
Friend to children, in a way that's today a little bit hard to understand. Spent lots of time with very young kids, not his own, photographing them extensively, sometimes controversially, including the photographs of Alice Liddell, sort of kind of half undressed. How do you interpret his friendship with so many very young children, including Alice Liddell?
It's a very, very difficult question to answer truthfully, and that's largely because we don't live in the world he lived in. You might remember there's that illustration by John Tenniel in the original book, which shows Alice pulling apart the curtain and revealing a tiny door into Wonderland that she mm-hmm. can't squeeze through. Mm-hmm. Now, in some ways, that's a model for the problems that we've got in trying to understand Victorian Oxford. We too see it as something that's out of reach. We can't squeeze through the door. We can't imagine what it was to live there, a world where you could entertain children who weren't your own without accusations of, to put it frankly, paedophilia.
Mm-hmm.
But it's worth remembering that the word paedophile hadn't been invented. It wasn't invented until the early 20th century when Carol and Died, a Punch magazine, a satirical magazine, published an obituary, which was a poem. And the first line of that poem was "Lover of Children." Lover of children, of course, is an absolutely perfect translation of pedophile.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what it meant. What it meant was that he was someone who so cherished childhood innocence, he was prepared to do anything to keep it, even if that meant taking a real girl and then producing a little bubble of fantasy that she could stay in forever.
That Alice Little, in which she would never grow old, the Alice in Wonderland.
She would always be 7 years old, just like his photographs he took. And some of the more controversial photographs include a handful of nude studies of young girls. And again, we have great difficulties in trying to understand what they mean. And that might be because they are like those Victorian trick pictures where you see two happening at once. On the one hand, entirely innocent. On the other hand, perhaps something slightly less innocent.
Fabulous work in Alice in Wonderland, Beyond the Looking Glass, and more. Of course, her family also eventually cut him off. We'll look at what we know about why that happened, and also the whole world of fantasy opened by Charles Dodgson. We know him as Lewis Carroll in Alice in Wonderland. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking Alice in Wonderland. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the creation of the man and the girl behind Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll, the real Alice, and the Victorian era story of what, repression and fantasy. Robert Douglas Fairhurst is my guest from Oxford in England. His new book is The Story of Alice, Lewis Carroll, and the Secret History of Wonderland. Robert Douglas Fairhurst, remind us of that story, the afternoon on the Thames. Charles Dodgson, young Alice Little, maybe her sisters as well, and he's just riffing a tale, I guess, the origins of all this.
That's right. So he told them stories before, and Alice Little said that there were many stories that ended up in the waste paper baskets of the deanery. This was one, though, that she insisted that he write down, and she said, "I went on at him until he promised to write it down." And the origins of the story were, they are almost as famous as the story itself. Mm-hmm. Now, they involve a boat trip up the Thames, Carol rowing with his friend Robinson Duckworth, the three little girls. They stop for a picnic. He decides to tell them a story. He looks around. He's not sure what to say. And of course, they're on a riverbank. So, of course, the riverbank around Oxford is full of rabbits and full of rabbit holes. So in some ways, he was improvising based around what he could see. And then what happened next was, he said, well, it was like a step in the dark. Who knew what was going to happen to her after that? And I think what he did was draw on a range of different songs and skits and jokes that he'd already rehearsed, and he stitched them together into a story. And that's why when you read the story now, it has almost no plot.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an anthology.
Yes.
Disguised as a novel,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes. Curiouser and curiouser, but it does seem like all bits, when I Well, I try to think back on the story, and all I get is bits and pieces. Wonderful, vivid, unforgettable bits and pieces. But that
goes to the heart of the way he wrote. He was a compiler, an arranger. He loved jigsaw puzzles. He loved miscellanies. When he was a child, he put together family magazines full of bits and pieces. There was at one stage when he was writing a later fantasy called Sylvian Bruno, where he wanted to cut the whole thing up into a whole lot of strips and juggle them together and then send them off to the illustrator with a code telling him how to put them together again. You know, that was the way his mind worked. It was, an accumulating imagination.
And somehow, even without that powerful through narrative, the whole remained compelling decade after decade. Here, nearly a century later, Disney went at it again. Here, Alice in Wonderland from Disney. The Cheshire Cat here telling Alice more about the characters in Wonderland.
If I were looking for a white rabbit, I'd ask the Mad Hatter.
The Mad Hatter? No, I don't...
Or there's the March Hare in that direction.
Thank you. I think I shall visit him.
Of course, he's mad too.
But I don't want to go among mad people.
Oh, you can't help that. Most everyone's mad here.
And there we are in Wonderland with Alice. Robert Douglas Fairhurst has written up the whole story in his new book, The Story of Alice. Jonathan's calling from Cookeville, Tennessee. Jonathan, you're on with Professor Douglas Fairhurst in Oxford, England.
Hi, it's good to be on. I just wanted to let you know that the first time I encountered Alice was actually in Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland movie that came out here in the 2000s. But I fell in love with the story, and I went back and watched the old Disney animated film from the 50s, and I read all the books, and I really fell in love with how the story meshed logic and fantasy into this kind of wonderful bit of enjoyment. And I've gone back and read about Alice Little and Lewis Carroll, or Charles Dodson, however you prefer to address him, I think it's a remarkable tale, and I'm quite glad that it existed and that those two people in real life actually existed and had the relationship they did that brought forth a book like that.
Jonathan, thanks for your call. Robert, what about the story and the elements of it that people found then and find now so compelling? What do you point to?
Well, it's interesting that Jonathan there said that he first came across the story through a film, through the Tim Burton film in 2010. A lot of careers in film have been based on the Alice books. For instance, Walt Disney. Disney founded Disney Studios in the 1920s through the success of what he called Alice comedies, 56 short films which involve a real little girl going to sleep and then visiting cartoon land. And in some ways, it's film that shows us why the story has been as successful as it has, because film, especially cartoons, are a way in which you can dream while you're awake. And that's what the books give us. The books are not just about a little girl dreaming. They are written like a dream. It's the nearest we can get to dreaming while we've got a book in our hands.
You say Charles Dodson cherished childhood and something about the innocence of it, but yet the story that unfolds in Alice in Wonderland is anything but sweet and comforting. It's quite terrifying at many moments.
Yes, it is. I mean, at various times, Alice is at risk of being trampled by a puppy, and a pigeon beats her in the face with its wings. The first thing that the Dormouse says when he has a list of things beginning with M is mouse traps. I mean, it reminds us that this is a story that is told on a bank, and it's 3 years after Darwin publishes The Origin of Species, which, of course, ends with a description of an entangled bank. And Darwin points out that there is a struggle for survival going on all over the world, which might be invisible unless you look very, very closely. So, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world, or maybe a dog-eat-cat world if you're the Cheshire Cat.
And here from Tim Burton's version, Alice in Wonderland, the Red Queen taking on the Knave of Hearts.
Majesty, Alice has escaped.
How could you let this happen?
Have underestimated her, but we have her conspirators, the Hatter and a Dormouse.
Off with their heads!
Off off with their heads. It is not all fun and games in Wonderland. Elizabeth in Miami, Florida, you're on with Robert Douglas Fairhurst.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I would like your guest to confirm or maybe dispel the rumor that Lewis Carroll was an ingester of opium, and also the connection that's been made with the psychotropic mushroom in the story.
Elizabeth, that's a very interesting question. It's largely because of the Jefferson Airplane song White Rabbit and some of the adaptations done in the 1960s by people like Jonathan Miller that we perhaps now think of it as being a story which is a fable of drug use. You see a mushroom and it changes you. I mean, hell, you'd think it must be about drugs, surely. Mm. Interestingly, there isn't any evidence that was in Carroll's mind at the time. Smoking a hookah pipe could be used for opium, but then as now it could be used for tobacco. Did he take drugs himself? There is nothing in his diaries or his letters that suggest that he did. But on the other hand, a lot of people took opium in various forms just as a over-the-counter remedy. It was called laudanum, mm-hmm. And it was as common then as headache tablets are today. And of course, that would have had certain effects on him, and he might have thought it was so ordinary as to not be worth mentioning. So I think it's not deliberately a sort of story about drug taking, but that's not to say that the drugs might not have had some vague influence on the way his mind worked.
Was he admired for the wild imagination of this tale, or was that something with which he was uncomfortable? You said he didn't really like to be associated with Alice in Wonderland publicly. Did the fantasy element of it have something to do with that?
I don't think so. I mean, his work as a mathematician and also his devotion to the established church both relied on what he called an absolute distinction between right and wrong. And of course, what fantasy gave him was an opportunity to muddle that line between right and wrong. There's another letter in which he says, "We are beings of very mixed motives." And of course, fantasy gave him the opportunity to put that sense of mixed motives into writing. A pun or a portmanteau word, mm-hmm. Or a joke. These are ways in which you can say more than one thing at the same time. But there's no evidence that he was embarrassed by it. In some ways, this was a logic going on holiday. This was a mathematician letting off steam.
And yet we've got the even tape of another sort of contemporary, this Ethel Hatch, who was another of the child friends of Charles Dodgson, Lewis Carroll. He photographed her as well, invited her for tea and walks when she was a young child. And much later, in the 1960s, she talked with the radio journalist Florence Lennon, described Lewis Carroll's reaction to being known for Alice in Wonderland.
He was called downstairs as two ladies had come to see him. And when he returned, he seemed very much put out and said, "How I do dislike to be pointed out as the man who wrote Alice in Wonderland."
How he did dislike. It's hard now to see how a book with so much adulation would leave. What was it, just the publicity?
He would have been the worst possible client today for a publicist. I mean, can you imagine you're working in a publisher's office and you say, "I'd like to go on a program like On Point"? I mean, he would have been hiding under
running,
the table.
Yeah.
Exactly. "My constant aim," he said, "is to remain personally unknown to the world." I think it's about a question of control, isn't it? He liked revealing himself to individual children as the author of Alice in Wonderland, but then he was in charge. Then it could be something which was a treat, a surprise for them. He hated the idea of being turned into a commodity or just being a kind of peddler of books for children.
Carolyn Vega joins us from New York City. Robert, stand by there in Oxford. Carolyn is curator of the Morgan Library and Museum. She's curated the upcoming exhibit, Alice, 150 Years of Wonderland, this being the sesquicentennial year. Carolyn Vega, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me on.
You have all kinds of drawings and items, articles from his life and his work. What image does it bring to mind? What kind of man, what kind of imagination when you look across this great collection?
Definitely a very imaginative author, and one who was interested in the relationship between image and text from the very beginning. The illustrations in the original manuscript, and even back to his juvenilia, a lot of pairing of image and text.
Describe his juvenilia. It's fascinating, the drawings and more that you've got, we'll have on display here.
So we will have on display his earliest surviving manuscript, which is a magazine that he wrote for his younger brothers and sisters, or his younger brother and sister, open to a poem called The Tale of a Tale, which is a sort of early example of him playing, interested in puns and wordplay and homonyms. So it's actually a tale or a story about a dog with a very long tail, and it's, illustrated throughout. So it sort of prefigures the mouse's tail that we come to in Alice much later.
Can you see in his early work his, I don't know if obsession is the right word, almost a fetish with children? When does it show up? And what about his photographs? Are you showing those as well of children sometimes not clothed?
Well, Lewis Carroll, Charles Dodson, was a very accomplished amateur photographer of the Victorian era, so he made about 3,000 photographs. We will have a selection of about a dozen photographs on view, mostly of Alice and her sisters, and a couple of Lewis Carroll as well. We will have one, Alice is the Beggar Maid, which is one of the more controversial photographs of her, but none of the nude ones. As Robert mentioned, there are only a handful surviving, and we don't have any of those.
I mean, the Beggar Maid, by contemporary standards, looks fairly tame compared to a Calvin Klein ad. But
yes.
But at the time, the sort of things off the shoulder and the girl quite young. I mean, even now, when you look at it, Carolyn, does it look kinky to you, or how do you see it?
Well, it's an arresting photograph and can be a little bit unsettling to our modern eyes. So she's leaning against a garden wall, dressed in these rags, sort of holding out her hand, asking for alms. One important thing to keep in mind is that it's probably composed as an allegorical photograph. So it was taken the same day as, probably, and likely meant to be paired with a photograph of Alice in her best dress as well. So to sort of look at the two together. Another thing to remember about the photograph that I'm looking at here is Lewis Carroll had this print hand-colored, so it has these lovely tints of pink in her skirt, and the nasturtiums are this, pale green, and the bright white of her dress. So he had this professionally hand-colored and gave it to the Little family, and they kept it in their possession. Alice kept it until 1928. She had fallen on hard times and decided to auction the original manuscript that Carroll had given to her, and auctioned this photograph as well. So it was something that they kept in the family. Although it is, her gaze is very direct and almost knowing. So it's unsettling. It's a little unsettling to look at.
At the same time, she seems to trust the man behind the camera. Of course, she's a child. We'll look at the rest of that story. Carolyn Vega's curating the upcoming exhibit, Alice, 150 Years of Wonderland, at the Morgan Library and the Museum in New York City. Carolyn, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Robert Douglas Fairhurst is author of The Story of Alice, Lewis Carroll, and the Secret History of Wonderland. He joins us from Oxford, England. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Music here from Tim Burton's film, 2010. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the creation of the man and the girl behind Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll, the real Alice, and the story 150 years old this year. Robert Douglas Fairhurst is my guest with us from Oxford, England, author of the new book, getting very good reviews, The Story of Alice, Lewis Carroll, and the Secret History of Wonderland, tells the story of the Oxford mathematician Charles Dodgson, who wrote the story of Alice Little, who was among the many children that he befriended, kind of infatuation with, maybe intellectual, maybe otherwise, hard to say. We'll look at that. Here's a little bit from the 1985 movie Dream Child, and it portrays that summer afternoon, 1862, when Dodgson and young Alice Little were on the Thames. He was telling her the story that became Alice in Wonderland. Here's Dodgson, played by Ian Holm, tells Alice, played by Amelia Shankly, about the March Hare and the Hatter for the first time.
The Hatter, who was quite mad, and the March Hare, equally mad, of course, were already there, having their tea. A Dormouse was sitting between them. Well, I say sitting. In fact, he was fast asleep. The other two were using it as a cushion.
A what?
A cushion.
How very uncomfortable for the Dormouse.
An afternoon on the Thames and a story a few years later for all the world to read. Alfred is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Alfred, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Yes.
Well, I've just always thought of, you know, because obviously Alice in Wonderland was kind of a coping mechanism for Dodgson, and it sort of was his release from the, you know, the strictures of Victorian society. And it sort of became that for Victorian society as well, an escape, you know, from the high pressure of, you know, public appearance and so forth. But I feel like that's useful in our own time, and it's certainly been useful in my lifetime. When you look at the absurdities in Lewis Carroll's work, it kind of gives you a sense of perspective on the absurdity of, you know, of our times. I mean, I'm in my 50s, mm-hmm. and I know that in my lifetime, I feel like it's been increasingly through the looking glass kind of situation. And the older I get, the more insane things become. And to the extent that we even have our own tea party, right? I mean, it's insane. And I just think, you know, I don't really know, you know, how much crazier it can get. But one thing that helps is to see that someone was able to laugh at it and see the amusing side of it. And so that's what I do with it.
Could I come in there,
yes,
Alfred?
Please.
It's a wonderful way of thinking about it. Again, there was an obituary of Carroll published, which said that we are all Alice's more or less. We are all Alice's more or less. And what's happened to the books since 1865 is they've become these carnival mirrors, which reflect distorted versions of everything that we throw at them. Mm-hmm. And that's why each generation has reinvented the story for itself. So, for the suffragettes, Alice was a suffragette. In the First World War, she was in the First World War. In the 1960s, she was a creature of flower power, and so on and so on. Now, yes, you might think of her as being someone who is either for or against a tea party. And that's what makes them so interesting, that they do seem to be this this lightning conductor, or this way of taking the temperature of everything that's going on around us.
Did Dodgson, Lewis Carroll, write it as an exploration of a child's view of the world, or as a cautionary tale for children about how mad the world could be?
Well, I think what's interesting is that just as he was two people in one, the story is two books in one. On the one hand, it is a way of looking through the eyes of a child and imagining the world through the distorting lens of a dream, so that you have a world then of mysterious pets and arbitrary and confusing rules and grown-ups who just shout at you and make no sense. But at the same time, it's a story seen from the perspective of an adult who is desperate to get back through that door into Wonderland, into the world of childhood. That's what Virginia Woolf meant, I think, when she says that these are not only books written for children, they're the only books in which you become children.
Let's go to Richard in Cleveland, Ohio. Richard, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I read a book years ago called The Annotated Alice, where it said that Alice in Wonderland was a satire and that the caterpillar was Disraeli because he smoked opium, that the Make Me Small, Make Me Large was about laudanum and other drugs that people were taking at that time, and that Lewis Carroll, because he was a minister, I'm sorry, I'm on the street, basically was preaching to people using the satire of the story. I'd like your guests to comment on that book I wrote read years ago, The Annotated Alice.
Richard, we'll do it. Disraeli as the caterpillar and right on down. Is there satire here? Up into it, including the Queen, perhaps?
Well, there's definitely an element of satire in it. I suppose the thing to remember is this is supposed to be a dream. And the world of dreams for the Victorians, as for Freud, is one in which A doesn't necessarily only equal B. It can also equal C and D and E and more. So although, yes, there might well be shadings of satire, contemporary satire, it's also a world in which one thing means many things, just as individual words curl up into puns and into portmanteaus. So trying to find single sources for any of the characters, I think, is doomed, because in the world of a dream, everything is more than it seems.
Let's go to Bill in Hartford, Connecticut. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering if we could confirm a story I heard years ago when I was an English major in college. Mm. Supposedly, when Queen Victoria read Alice in Wonderland, she was so taken with it that she wrote to Dodgson and said, "We enjoyed your story very, very much. We were wondering if you could send us any other of your works." And what I had heard was that he had sent her one of his math treatises.
Bill, it's one of my favorite stories as well. I wish it were true, and sadly, there is no evidence it is true. It's such a shame, because it's one of those stories that's so good you would want it to be true, but sadly, there isn't. However, there is, interestingly, in the Royal Collection, they have a copy of Alice in Wonderland signed by Alice Liddell, in which she signs herself Alice in Wonderland. And that's something she did increasingly as she got older. She would be willing to sign herself as the real Alice in Wonderland. So although she too, like Carol, was something of a reluctant celebrity, and there's a letter after she comes to New York in which she says, you know, "I am tired of being Alice in Wonderland." You know, she was still not above pushing towards getting some of the perks of her position.
Lots of sort of tension around how she saw that, many different depictions of it. Here's a little bit again from the movie 1985 Dream Child, and this an elderly Alice Liddell, now Hargrave, here is on a journey that she actually took in life to the United States, but here in the film version she's reflecting on that long ago relationship with Charles Dodgson. Lewis Carroll, Alice, played by here by Coral Brown, responds to an American reporter who wants her to tell Americans her story.
"We all want you to be the little girl you once were."
"Oh, the little girl Mr. Dodgson made me out to be, you mean 70 years ago?"
"Yes, yes. Lewis Carroll's Alice."
"Oh, that's intolerable. It's quite intolerable. It would be difficult enough at my age to be what I once was, but utterly impossible to be what I never was."
Robert Douglas Fairhurst, we have many people online asking about the rest of her story, whether and how Lewis Carroll, Charles Dodgson, was cut off from her family, and how the rest of her life unfolded.
Well, there was a break with the family. It's still a mysterious break, largely because at some stage someone from the Dodgson family went through and cut out the relevant page from his diary. So we simply don't know why the the Liddles broke off with him. There are lots of rumours now, as there were then. Had he proposed marriage at some stage in the future? It wouldn't have been unheard of at the time for an older man to propose to a much, much younger girl.
What was their age difference?
Well, it was big. So he would have been 30 in 1862 and she was 10. But then the future Archbishop Benson proposed to his bride when she was 12 years old.
Didn't Dodgson's own brother marry a very, very young girl or propose to a very young girl?
Well, yes, and Carroll himself took a photograph he called The Elopement, which was of a very young girl called Alice Dorkin, climbing out of a window. And indeed, his brother waited until she was 18, and then they married quite happily, as it turned out. And of course, it wasn't only in Britain this was happening. Edgar Allan Poe married his cousin when she was only 13. And in Britain, the age of consent was 12 in 1865. It was then raised to 13, and it was only raised to 16 in 1885 after a scandal about child prostitution. So the whole concept of the child is one which was shifting through Carroll's life.
Why were adults, what was it they were so thirsting for there? People will today, again, suspect it was a sexualization. Was that it? Was there something else? Take us back to that question.
Well, to be honest, you look at or you read about some of the ways in which children were being used and abused in the 19th century. And it reminds me of certain contemporary practices like beauty pageants for, you know, 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds, where they are put into adult clothing and slathered with makeup. And it's something like a parody of a knowing adult beauty pageant, a mixture of sentimentality and sexualizing. And that in some ways is that collision you get in the Victorian mind as well. On the one hand, children are little models, little beacons of innocence that light up the moral fog around them. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, there are child prostitutes who are being used because they don't carry venereal disease. And you put those two ideas together and you have an extremely uneasy, queasy mixture. And it's, I think, trying to negotiate that Carroll was, well, he was trying to do that for his entire life. But at the same time, pushing his own innocence to the limits, I think, to try and work out where those limits were.
Where do you come down on that? After all your reading and research, how do you understand the heart of his relationship with all those many, many young children he befriended, as you say?
Well, I think if what you're asking me in effect is, was he a paedophile? I think if he was a secret paedophile, it was such a good secret, even he wasn't in on it. And what I mean by that is that there is absolutely no evidence that survives either in his own words or in the words of other people who knew him very well.
But the pages of the diary are gone. We live in the age of Michael Jackson in Neverland.
Of course. And, you know, it's tempting to think that where there is a blank, that where there is a gap, mm-hmm. you fill it with the worst possible scenario.
I'm not
here as his defender. I've tried mm-hmm. to be as, you know, balanced and, you know, judicious as I can in the mm-hmm. book. I think the important thing with Carroll is to recognize that, it's not just that if he had a secret, he seems to have been unaware of it himself. It's also that so much of his life is now blank to us, the world around it and that central relationship. And in fact, what we then do is we fill it with our own fears about our own culture. That's why the Red Queen in Through mm-hmm. the Looking Glass says, what do you suppose is the use of a child without any meaning? And what we've mm-hmm. done with the Alice books and with their relationship is we have filled it with our own meanings, which of course turns out also to be our own fears and our own insecurities.
I guess ultimately I'm more interested in the great generosity of storytelling that he shared after reading your work here. Peg in Chamonix, New York. Peg, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just, over the decades of my life, I've reacted to it differently as a young child. It frightened me. Mm-hmm. And then in my early teens, I began to enjoy it. And in college, I took a children's literature course and studied it more. And now I just really, really appreciate the characters that developed in the story and those personalities. So I've just, it's kind of been like peeling an onion for me over my lifetime.
Did you share that kind of sometimes terrifying topsy-turvy imagination when you were a child, Peg?
A little bit. I started out on Grimm's Fairy Tales, but I've never been able to grasp or get right into science fiction and fantasy anyway. I'm always looking for reality, and you have to be able to suspend that a lot. You have to be able to suspend that.
Peggy, I appreciate your call. Robert Douglas Fairhurst, our time grows short after all these years, 150 here. Alice in Wonderland remains a book that everyone knows, whether they've read it or not. It stands for something about untrammeled imagination. Does it go on as a metaphor for something about the child's imagination perpetually?
I think that's right. What Carol was very keen to show in the story was that Wonderland is not a place, it is a state of mind. It is an attitude that you can take to the ordinary, everyday world around you, and you can suddenly bring it alive with a sense of possibility and of surprise, if only you have those fresh eyes. And what the story does is show you that world through a child's eyes, and it then helps you to rediscover those eyes yourself.
Do you end up an admirer of Charles Dodson, Lewis Carroll?
I am an admirer of him. I think that a lot of his life was unhappy. I think that he did try and make good his life in the story, and I'm very grateful he did.
Still being read all over today, a kind of a poetic little door through which we all can travel. Robert Douglas Fairhurst tells the story in his new book, The Story of Alice, Lewis Carroll, and the Secret History of Wonderland. Robert Douglas Fairhurst, thank you very much for joining us from Oxford today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Caitlin O'Keefe, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. This is On Point.